This podcast is presented by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at www.uctv.tv. Enjoy the presentation.
Well, I should start off by saying I make no pretense of answering the question of whether the incidence is increasing or not. But I think it's very important to be asking questions about, even if it's just a possibility that it's increasing, we should be doing things to try to understand that and document what the final answer really is. There are certain things where you can, Time Magazine says, and the number of new cases is exploding. And this chart, which comes from the California Health Department, seems to be one of the most popular pieces of evidence that's cited as far as the increase in incidence. And here, this looks like something like an eightfold increase in incidence starting in the 70s, getting going into the 80s, and then rising precipitously, say, from the mid-80s to the mid-90s. The California legislature commissioned a study by the MIND Institute, which has this statement taken from the study. Without evidence of an artifactual increase in autism cases, we conclude that some, if not all, of the observed increase represents a true increase in cases of autism in California, and the number of cases presenting to the regional center system is not an overestimation of the number of children with autism in California. Not everybody agrees as to what's going on by any means. Probably one of the skeptics that's been very outspoken in published literature is Eric Fombone, and this is from JAMA in 2003, but even he has come around to the following position. Therefore, from available evidence, it can be concluded that recent rates of both ASD, autism spectrum disorder, and autism disorder are 3 to 4 times higher than 30 years ago. So at this point, I think everybody agrees we're diagnosing more children with autism, but there is not agreement as to whether this represents an artifactual change in the way we make the diagnosis or whether there really is a biological change in the occurrence of the disorder. Fombone's skepticism is indicated here, and he talks about unless we have really good controls and everything, that we're really not sure that we can conclude this, and he ends with a comment that claims about an epidemic of autism and its putative causes have the most weak empirical support. So we don't know if it's increasing or not. I was asking some people today, my general experience, particularly in asking people who've been seeing autistic patients for 20 or 30 years in California, whether they think it's increasing or not, and most say yes. You know, we didn't used to see this number of kids with this kind of problem, but the population has grown. It's not an easy answer. I think we really need to know the answer as to whether the increase that has been documented in the past is an artifact or is real. It's not enough to simply start getting a better study in place and monitor what's the current incidence and is the future incidence going to be higher or lower. I think that we really need to know retrospectively, if at all possible, if the supposed or the apparent increase in the past is real or not. This can be a very, very difficult epidemiological study to do retrospective studies like this. But I don't think it's acceptable to throw up our hands and say retrospective studies like this are very difficult and we'll never know, so we just have to move on. If there's an environmental factor, its identification is likely to have enormous potential for prevention, certainly. If we, the human population, have changed something in the environment that's doing this, we ought to change it back. And it's likely that if we did know and understand such a factor, that it would likely have importance for understanding the related causes and importance for potential treatment. And the needed research is primarily with the responsibility of the Centers for Disease Control, or CDC, And I believe that there is not sufficient focus on retrospective studies to know if it really has changed or not. I recognize these studies are very hard to get good answers. So first, I'm going to take a genetic detour because I think there's been changes going on in the diagnosis of mental retardation, and some of these go over into the area of autism, and particularly with the children who have lower functioning autism and some dysmorphic features. Now, for those of you who've been here for the previous lecture, this is a bit of a repeat, so I'll just quickly say that there are a group of autism patients where you can identify a specific abnormality, and I want to talk a little bit about this group, how it's a growing group, and particularly with one new laboratory test, we're seeing some significant changes. And again, I showed this slide previously, and there's a group of patients who you can identify in the autism total population that have chromosomal and single gene disorders. There are sex chromosome abnormalities, there are duplications of chromosome 15, deletions of the 22q telomere where there's a SHANK3 gene, there's duplications of the MECP gene, with MECP2 gene, which is the RET gene, and there are other single gene disorders that are listed over here. What's really happened is that there's been a really major revolution in our ability to diagnose the cytogenetic abnormalities, and particularly very small cytogenetic abnormalities. And that's reflected here as each of these various spots on these chromosomes show reports of cases of deletions or duplications of chromosomal material. You can see sometimes they're quite common, other times they're quite rare. So this is a normal male chromosome analysis. You can see there's two chromosome number one, two number two, an X and a Y, and a female analysis looks similar except there's two X's instead of an X and a Y. You get a very, very crude look at the DNA information here. But there's, in recent years, tests such as fluorescence in situ hybridization where you can see a particular spot in the chromosome with much more sensitivity, and a variation on this theme of a comparative genomic hybridization, or CGH, is a new technology that looks at many, many different bits of the genome using bits of DNA put on a glass slide, and you can see things that you can't see ordinarily with a microscope. This is a FISH test in an individual with Down syndrome or trisomy 21, and there are three copies of chromosome 21, and you can see these three red dots here. This is at a time in the cell cycle called the metaphase, where you can see the individual chromosomes, and then you can have at another portion in the cell cycle, the chromosomes are not sort of thickened up like this, but are spread out, and you get just this big blue haze, but still there's three dots for chromosome 21. And the green probe here is a different chromosome, that which there's two copies. Now, we really can do lots of this kind of thing, and this chromosome here, is you can see people have taken and done FISH all the way along it, and what we really have the ability to do now is to put thousands of checks for different presence or absence of DNA along these chromosomes. I should state here that I chair a department that has a major conflict of interest here in that we generate significant revenue by offering this kind of laboratory testing around the country. For example, we do all of the testing for Boston Children's Hospital and many other send-out laboratories. We think this is a good new test. We think it's particularly relevant to autism because of some of the kinds of abnormalities that are present. But you have to understand we have run a business of sorts in a not-for-profit organization here. Now, so we think ArrayCGH is a major new development in genetic diagnosis and is to a large extent an outgrowth of the Human Genome Project. We think it will replace conventional chromosome testing. So here we have what an array looks like, where each of these spots is a particular clone or oligonucleotide, a particular spot in the DNA. We take a control sample, a normal individual and a test individual, and we label their DNA with two different colored dyes, and then we match them up on and see how they bind to each of these spots. If the spot involves a normal region, you get this yellowish color, which you see is the majority of what you see. But if the patient has more or less DNA for a particular region compared to the control, we'll see, say, a greenish or reddish coloration. You can see here this spot is green. We do the experiment twice, so if this spot is green, we reverse the colors and it should be red this time, which it is. And this just shows the red and the green spot among the group at a higher magnification. This is how we display the data in our laboratory. Here's a normal female compared to a normal male. We've done the experiment twice, and one experiment is in the red dots and one is in the blue dots. The chromosomes go from number 1 at the top on down through number 22, and then the X and the Y. We get so-called raw data. This is then managed statistically to normalize certain artifacts in the system. And you can see that for all of the chromosomes at the top, everything's falling along the center line. Down at the bottom here, red's going one direction and blue's going the opposite direction. And that reflects the fact that there is a true difference in these samples. One has two X's and the other has an X and a Y. And so you see that the results sort of fall along this center line all the way down till we get to the X when they're showing a gain, and Y is showing a loss compared to the female. Here we've taken these data in blue and flipped the sign and put them all so that they're in the same direction. And so this basically is a sum of the combined output of the two experiments. If we take two individuals who are normal and have the same sex, you see this is what a normal result would look like. And you see everything sort of falls along the bottom line. And what you'll see here is that you'll quickly be able to identify abnormal from normal results, and that it's much simpler to interpret than historically the chromosome analysis has been. At the present time, all abnormalities are confirmed by FISH or partial karyotype, and this is just to keep everybody comfortable at a time of transition in the technology. We do need to, when we find an abnormality, there are reasons to sort of get additional information. In other words, if we find extra part of DNA, we don't necessarily know what chromosome it's on unless we do a FISH test. So this is an example of Down syndrome. And here you see the normal chromosomes for until you get to number 21, where there's three copies of chromosome 21. Here's the array analysis by comparison. You get down to chromosome 21, and you can see everything is showing a gain for chromosome 21. So this is how the array interpret result would look versus the traditional karyotype result. And this you saw before. Now, it's been really impressive how we've been able to make diagnoses in children with various kinds of abnormalities. This is just an example of one of our more common diagnoses. A child with unusual facial features, cleft lip and palate, growth failure, congenital heart disease, and normal chromosome studies at birth. But when you do the chromosome analysis here by the array, you see that there's some spots that are deviating to the left here. This is our earlier version 4 where we had fewer clones, and now a version 5 where we have more clones. And you can see that there's a group of dots again here. And these represent a deletion of the tip of chromosome 1, which you really couldn't recognize by karyotype. In retrospect, once you see it, you line these up, you think maybe it's this one that's deleted, but you really can't be sure. And again, you can see that a very minimally trained person can see that there's a bunch of clones that are outside the normal range here, and you can also statistically have the computer tell you which ones they are and that they're not normal. This is a particularly interesting phenomenon. The RET gene, which is one gene associated with a disability primarily in females, has extra copies in certain males. We used to think RET syndrome was almost exclusively in females. Now we know that there's an equal number, if not more, males who have a variation on the theme. So they don't have a change in the letters of the DNA for the RET gene, but they have extra copies. Here, actually, this individual has three copies. You see this group of clones are deviated far to the right. And you can see there's three red dots compared to the one green dot. It turns out that duplications of this region are one of the most common findings that we're seeing in patients with autism. Also, this is very important for genetic counseling. This is such a family. You can see there's many deceased males. These males typically have a fair amount of encephalopathy and are often dying in the range of 10 to 20 years of age. And very often the females in the family are carriers, and this particular individual is living still, and we had a chance to see this individual on our GCRC recently. But so in families with X-linked mental retardation, in which all of the tests up to now have been normal, this is a very good possibility, particularly if there's a fairly severe deficit. So our diagnostic lab, through the summertime, had run about 5,000 samples. These are different kinds of abnormalities, and I've circled three in yellow that are particularly found in autism. 10 are duplications of the Prader-Willi-Angelman region. This is 10 that are deletions of this chromosome 22 tip of the long arm, and then 12 cases of duplications of the RET gene. Now, of those 5,000, 430 had on the lab slip some mention of autism. So either the lab slip said autism or PDD-NOS or autistic features or something like that. Now, sometimes people send us samples where they already know there's one chromosome abnormality. They're interested in seeing if we can find more. In this case, we had some XXY and XYY individuals and so on. But the interesting cases are that there were 19 cases where we made a definitive diagnosis of the underlying cause out of 340 for about 4.4%, where autism was mentioned on the lab slip. Now, obviously, we don't really know much about these patients. They came from all over the country. All we know is that something about autism was on the lab slip. But the only disorder that we saw more than once was the four cases of duplications of the MECP2 gene. So we think this is a particularly common abnormality. And we did see some of the other abnormalities once that are known to be associated with autism, like the duplication of 15 and the deletion of 22QTER. And then we had one each of 12 other abnormalities. So my feeling would be that based on this, maybe if you took individuals who had a normal chromosome analysis and a diagnosis of autism, and you do this test, something like maybe 4% of the time, you may identify the underlying abnormality. This number, I think, is still going up as we're improving this test. I think it's much more likely that you'll make a diagnosis in a child who is dysmorphic and who has some degree of mental retardation, and much less likely in a child who looks phenotypically quite normal and is high functioning. So now back to this question. The detour is over. So these seem to be the two favorite of the lay press, some families, some lawyers, childhood vaccines, and thimerosal. I think that the mainstream medical community feels like there's quite good data that childhood vaccines are not a problem. And there's also not much evidence to support the idea that thimerosal is a problem. But there are many people who feel strongly that this is the case. I think that foregoing childhood vaccines is, I think, not a good idea given this anxiety. But I don't have much to add to the voluminous material that's already in the lay press and the scientific press about these candidates. But they don't seem, to my mind, to be very strong candidates. There are a number of others, many of which have to do with pregnancy, and I'll comment on a few of them more than others. Prenatal ultrasound is a fascinating one and a frightening one, really, and I'll show you some data about that. Prenatal steroids, it's common if a baby's going to be delivered prematurely to give the mother steroids for some hours or a day or so before the delivery in order to try to encourage lung maturation. Epidural anesthesia is something that wasn't used much 30 years ago, but is used very widely now. There are some drugs, magnesium sulfate, which is used in the pregnancy situation in certain abnormalities. The possibility that maternal and paternal age trends have changed in terms of the typical age of fathers and mothers when they're having children. There's a group of drugs that are used to try to prevent premature delivery. These are called tocolytic drugs, or tocolysis is the attempt to delay preterm delivery. and one compound called terbutaline is particularly suspect. There's some concern that artificial in vitro fertilization or assisted reproductive technologies, and particularly a procedure called ICSI, or intracytoplasmic sperm injection, might be of some concern. I guess if I would have to say one thing is chemical exposures is really a big concern, and Dr. Isaac
Pesa.
Pesa. I met for the first time last weekend, and he gave us a presentation in Boston, and I must say it was very enlightening and quite frightening, and he emphasized the concerns in this area. And then my sort of personal favorite is folic acid, and I'll say some more about that. So this is an article from relatively recently in Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences about prenatal exposure to ultrasound waves impacts neuronal migration in mice. They said, our analysis of over 335 animals reveals that when exposed to ultrasound waves for a total of 30 minutes or longer during the period of their migration, a small but statistically significant number of neurons fail to acquire their proper position and remain scattered within inappropriate cortical layers and or in subjacent white matter. This is their cartoon of what they were seeing under the microscope. Where cells start to arise in this location, they migrate out this way, they get out here to these various layers. And this is the normal pattern. And in the mice that were treated with ultrasound, you can see that there's a delay in this migration, and the cells don't ever get out to the fully normal kind of place where they should be. So there's some occasional abnormalities. Therefore, they conclude our results in pregnant mice support the recommendation by the Food and Drug Administration that warn against the use of medically non-indicated or commercial prenatal ultrasound video. So ultrasound studies in the mall for kind of recreational purposes and sort of I understand people's attachment to the watching, being able to watch the fetus is absolutely fascinating. But I think it's extremely unwise at this point in time to be liberal about just sort of more recreational ultrasound. And they also call for careful testing, and they talk about the importance of it is essential to examine the possible effects of ultrasound waves on cortical development in non-human primates. And given the expertise here at Davis in Primate Center and so on, it might be a particularly good environment in which to look at the potential effects of prenatal ultrasound. So it's possible that you certainly can say increasing use of prenatal ultrasound across this period would be a hypothetical factor. And it would also be, it would be a good example of if it were doing something, you know, we certainly could restrict its use, use shorter intervals, understand more about the relationship of the interval, the kind of equipment, the intensity, and so on. This is an article that appeared recently about advancing paternal age in autism. And these investigators found there was a significant increase of association with advancing paternal age. Offspring of men 40 years or older were 5.7 times more likely to have autism spectrum disorder compared with offspring of men younger than 30. And this controls for birth, socioeconomic status, and age of the mother. Now, we know that advanced paternal age is associated with certain kinds of genetic mutations. This, I think, is something that is not exactly environmental, but is behavioral on the basis of the population. And it also gives us an idea that we know something about how to look for these kinds of mutations that are associated with advanced age of the father. And we might take children who have particularly older fathers, fathers who are in their 50s and 60s, and see whether we can find a genetic abnormality which would be anticipated to be new in that child and associated with the sperm production in an older father. ICSI is this intracytoplasmic sperm injection. And there have been a series of reports about the possibility of abnormalities causing particularly Angelman syndrome and another syndrome called Beckwith-Wiedemann syndrome. So there have been various reports here, which I've tabulated, but I won't go through with you in detail. This ICSI procedure is kind of a really crude thing. They take a needle and they suck up a sperm into it. They jam the needle into the egg and they shoot the sperm in there. And ordinarily, the sperm contacts the egg, goes through a series of complex biological manipulations, leaves the tail outside, and goes through and has certainly, there's a lot of biology associated with the normal fertilization process. In this case, they just take the whole sperm, tail and all, ram it in there, and move on. And sometimes they even take sperm cells that are immature from a testis biopsy if a person has no sperm detectable, no sperm available. So, again, we're doing very little monitoring in the United States. This is more of a business than it is science, and it's a very expensive business and profitable business. So it's just, again, it's an area that we can worry about. Now, I think if these kinds of procedures are causing something, even retrospectively, we should be able to sort it out, although I would say ultrasound would be very difficult to sort out. But depending on whether the things that we're interested in might be in the medical record and how distinctive and unusual they are, we may or may not be able retrospectively to sort things out. So chemicals, last weekend I just met Dr. Pessa for the first time. He emphasized that major chemicals in the environment have increased exponentially. He was reluctant to speak, you know, publicly in a forum like this about what some of his sort of best guesses are of the things to be most worried about. But I wonder whether we should get some of these concerns out there. And there are some chemicals, household chemicals, some that might be more worrisome than others and so on, that people could try to avoid. But again, there's no proof, but I would say if you asked me if there's really an increase, what would the best chances be? I would say some of the thousands of chemicals we're all getting exposed to would be a really big area of concern, and I think this is a major emphasis of research here with Dr. Pessa and others trying to address this, and I think it's a very important topic. This drug terbutaline, which is used to try to postpone premature delivery, it's approved as a drug for asthma. I've met this woman, Beth Cowell, who's the mother of triplets, all diagnosed with autism. She was given terbutaline beginning in the 20th week of pregnancy with triplets. She believes terbutaline is the cause of her children's problem. She didn't just get terbutaline. She got terbutaline for weeks on end at home, injected subcutaneously. There's an FDA warning that the drug is not approved for this, so this is an off-label use. If it's used, it should be used 48 to 72 hours maximum, and the safety has not been addressed, especially on an outpatient basis. I think typically this happens in a child who also ends up being born prematurely. It's very tricky to interpret what's the cause of what. But again, terbutaline exposure is going to be documented if it occurs, and people will know if they were on it at home for weeks at a time and so on. There are some bits of evidence that in mice and rats, you can cause brain cell abnormalities with exposure to terbutaline even after birth in very young rodents. And just to show you that we really, it could be anything, and that there are some crazy ideas out there. This was in the press just recently. I'm sure many of you saw it in the lay press. Does television cause autism? Now, these guys are economists who wouldn't know autism from a hole in the ground. Putting out their information on a website with no peer review whatsoever, but that doesn't stop them. They say, in this paper, we empirically investigate the hypotheses that early childhood television viewing serves as such a trigger. They're talking about trigger for autism. And we then look at county-level autism data for three states, California, Oregon, and Washington, characterized by high precipitation variability. So their argument is that it rains a lot, so the kids stay in and watch television, and that gives them autism. I think this is, if I was to find an idea that looks like the most ridiculous, I would say this would rank as the most ridiculous. And they say these findings got consistent with early childhood television viewing being an important trigger for autism. So you can come up, everybody in this room could come up with a better hypothesis than this one. So I'm interested in epigenetics, which is an aspect of genetic control that doesn't involve the actual DNA sequence or the letters in the code, but some other modification over and above that. I like to look at this as a font. So the DNA four letters are CAGT, and you can have CAGT. Everything here is CAGT, but it can be big font, small font, caps, lowercase, color, strikeout. You know, it could be that you can put a lot of other information over and above the simple CAGT. We know that in the DNA, one way that that can be done is by making a chemical methyl modification of certain C letters in the code. So you can have a piece of DNA which has the C positions methylated, or the C positions can be unmethylated. So this is one example of how epigenetic information is encoded in the DNA. So epigenetics generally is any change in the font. All genes are involved, and it makes a brain cell different from a liver cell. Genomic imprinting I won't talk about very much. It's a special form of this where the genes behave differently depending on which copy came from the mother and which copy came from the father. Only a few genes are involved, and there's some disease situations and others. I showed this photo in the last hour. This was in 1986 and 87, we identified this girl who had two copies of chromosome 7 from her mother. She had cystic fibrosis because it was all one chromosome which got duplicated, and that chromosome had the CF mutation on it. And it also caused the short stature in her. So she has some abnormality of the epigenetic information, but if you sequenced her genome, the primary letters are all correct, but some of this font information is disturbed. Now, we became interested in this because the region we studied also can be involved in autism. So these are rare but well-documented cases of families where here's the mother, the father, two autistic boys. And if you look at DNA markers in a part of the genome we know has particular this genomic imprinting kind of information, you see that there's three peaks here for the two boys. And here's the father. He's got two peaks. And everything seems appropriate for the father's contribution. He contributes either one or the other of these two to each of his sons. He gives this one to this son, and he gives this one to this son. But the mother is giving two peaks. And she actually has three herself. She's got one copy of this peak and two copies of this peak. We know that if you have three copies of this region from your mother, you have autism with a very consistent finding. Whereas if you have the extra copy, as in this woman, on the chromosome from her father, you're perfectly normal. So this says this region of the genome on chromosome 15 that we've been interested in is of a potential importance in autism, and this epigenetic information may be particularly important because it makes a difference in whether you inherit a particular arrangement from your mother or your father, which for the DNA letters themselves it doesn't matter, but for the epigenetic information, or the font, it can matter. Now, folic acid has a very complicated role in metabolism and plays a role in creating the compound, some usually called SAM or S-adenosylmethionine, which makes for contributing the methyl group to DNA or other kinds of molecules. Usually, folic acid is given in this form of a sort of drugstore type of folic acid. It has to be chemically modified by an enzyme called dihydrofolate reductase to give another form, which then goes on to give another form and another form, and eventually this contributes to the formation of this SAM. Now, there's evidence if you give large amounts of folic acid that you can influence DNA methylation, And there's evidence that changing DNA methylation can change gene expression, particularly for imprinted genes. So we have this idea that at least in rare families with autism, there's something going on with an imprinted gene. I attended my first real autism research meeting in November of 2001. And I actually became aware for the first time in any significant way. I guess maybe it had kind of crossed the screen for me in lay press. But I became aware of this debate about whether there's an increased incidence or not. And so we were very focused on this chromosome 15 region, so we were interested in its role in autism. And we had this idea that folic acid might affect expression in this region, and I thought, sitting there in the audience, I thought to myself, if the increase in autism is real, folic acid would be a strong candidate factor. Now, folic acid in the early 70s was restricted by the FDA, and you could not put anything more than trace amounts in over-the-counter vitamins, and most over-the-counter vitamins had none. And also in the early 70s, in nutrition surveys conducted by the CDC, not that many people took a nutritional supplement, either in the form of a vitamin, a daily vitamin, or in the form of some ready-to-eat cereal. But as the years went by, we had increasing numbers of patients, maybe half the population, taking vitamins or eating vitamin-fortified cereals. In 1972, most of the over-the-counter vitamins had no folic acid, but they could have 0.1 milligrams was permissible by the FDA standard. In 1973, the FDA raised the over-the-counter limit to 0.4 milligrams, just some popular brands, one a day, had no folic acid in 1976, and then they switched to 0.4 milligrams. Vidalin had none till 1977, and they switched to 0.4 milligrams. So in the 70s, we began to see a certain subset of the population receiving more folic acid intake than had been the case. Whoops. Now, there are data here from a part of the Framingham study. And these are people who reported they did not take a vitamin supplement and people who reported they did take a vitamin supplement. And this is the plasma folate level in the early 90s in this population. They had folate levels of about 4.6. And in the population who said they took a vitamin supplement, they had a folate level of about three times that. And in 1995 to 98, everything had gone up a little bit from 4.6 to 4.8, and the supplement group had gone up from 11 to 14. So again, some evidence that the population is progressively getting more and more folic acid. So back to our chart. As I've shown you, that over-the-counter vitamins began to contain more folic acid in this interval of the late 70s, early 80s. We had the first report that neural tube defects could be prevented by giving folic acid. And in this interval, we began to get educational materials from, in the United States, groups like the March or Dimes, advising mothers to take more folic acid and to take folic acid prior to conception. And then finally, by the late 90s, we had the government getting involved in requiring that food be fortified, various grain products be fortified. So we have, again, this increasing folic acid intake that, you know, could reasonably be interpreted as potentially compatible with the time frame that we're looking at. This is an example that we know we can change gene expression. These are mice who have a particular kind of coat color marker that is influenced by DNA methylation. And here, these mice have been fed, the mothers of these mice, who were fed various amounts of folic acid, and if you give more folic acid, you change the gene expression, and so you get this darker coat color. So an example of how folic acid intake can change gene expression. This is an example in humans where normally you should have, all these individuals have the ability to make kind of an upper band or lower band and have the ability to produce both of these. But normally you should make only one of these two bands. You should either have the upper one or the lower one, depending on which is on your mother's copy of the chromosome and which is on your father's. And these are individuals who were on hemodialysis and had very high homocysteines, and you can see the individuals with the highest homocysteine abnormalities had both of these on. So while only one parental copy should be on, in fact, for these people who had very high homocysteines, which is a reflection of low folic acid intake, had this abnormality. But when they were given supplemental folic acid, everybody went back to having just one or the other and not both of these bands being present. So again, what this says is there are situations in humans where folic acid intake can change gene expression. So folic acid definitely changes the action of some genes, probably especially imprinted genes. The folic acid intake of the population at large, and particularly reproductive age women, has been dramatically increased over the last 3 decades. And your folic acid level and maybe imprinted gene expression are different today than they were 15 years ago. And we need to know more about whether folic acid intake is increasing or decreasing the incidence of certain diseases. So I'll stop at this point, and I'd be happy to try to take any questions.
Yeah, I was curious about the flu shots with the mercury that's in them. Before my son was conceived, I hadn't had a flu shot probably in 20 years, so I didn't think I needed one. I was about 40. My wife and I both got vaccinated prior to her getting pregnant. When she was pregnant, she had twins. She lost the first one. The second one was a 2/3 pregnancy. After that, we had our autistic child. Now, from what I've heard, they took the mercury out of some of the vaccinations that they give the children, but for some reason, they still have them in the flu shots. And I don't know what's going on with that, but because our son was born with some abnormalities, some genetic issues, too, that were obvious. So in addition to whatever problems he had prior to birth, the additional vaccinations that he got that probably had mercury or not, I don't know, but I don't know if I have any mercury in myself. I haven't tested, or my wife. But what do you?
We've all got. If you eat food, you have mercury in yourself, and you have different amounts depending on how much seafood you eat and particular kinds of fish and so on.
Different types of mercury, though, too, isn't it?
Yes, there are different types of mercury as well. So, I don't have particular expertise in this area. I think there has been an attempt to get the thimerosal out of most kinds of vaccines. It's there as a preservative, or was there as a preservative. One area which has been discussed a lot is it was present in Rogam, which was something given to Rh-negative women. Particularly, let's say, if they had a bleeding episode or they had an amniocentesis or something during the pregnancy, they would be given Rogam. If Rogam were a problem, first of all, if thimerosal is a problem, I would think that Rogam would be a huge exposure by comparison to a vaccine, because you give more of it, and I think the dose would be significant. And here again, I don't have the data, but if thimerosal is a problem and Rogam is a major source, then the incidence of autism in offspring of Rh-negative women with Rh-positive partners should be much higher than in other parts of the population, because a Rogam will only be given to a Rh-negative woman and will only be necessary if her husband is Rh-positive. So these are some of the retrospective kinds of things that I think need to be looked at, but I don't have particular expertise in the whole immunization, mercury, thimerosal level. I think if there's a child who has some genetic problems, I would say that the autism findings would likely be part of the underlying genetic abnormality, and there would be lots of circumstances where that would be the case, or we would interpret that to be the case. Whether we would always be making the right interpretation or not, I don't know.
R-H-O-G-A-M.
R-H-O-G-A-M.
Yes. I'm curious because you're discussing the increased intake of folic acid for women in their childbearing years and possibly during prenatal development. Currently, over the last few years, some of the children that have autism are now being exposed or given vitamin B as a therapy to increase language development. And what are your thoughts on that? Have you seen anything in the studies showing a delayed development after prenatal development?
So we've been interested in the idea that folic acid could induce worsening of findings in autism and maybe particularly worsening of behavior. And I hear from many clinical people that maybe 10% of children with autism respond badly in terms of a behavioral response if you give them large amounts of folic acid. So we've been particularly interested in that aspect, that maybe even not only that folic acid could be playing a role in utero, prior to conception, around the time of conception, or in the pregnancy, or even after birth. And we've been trying to, we have designed a study, it is currently being reviewed by the IRB, which would intentionally give higher doses of folic acid of the usual form, which we have some reason to think could be problematic, and then to also give them another form, which we think would be less problematic of folic acid. So I think there's possibilities that folic acid could be both beneficial and harmful, depending on the genetic makeup of the individual, and maybe based on some other circumstances as well. So we're trying to look at that, but it's not been so easy to really design a study. You certainly wouldn't want to, intentionally, give less folic acid to a woman knowing you would be for sure increasing the risk of a neural tube defect. And I would say that at the present time, there's clear evidence that folic acid prevents the incidence or lowers the incidence of a very serious birth defect. And by no means would I say that we should encourage women not to take it or to take less. I do think we need more data so that if it's potentially a problem, we may have to find out that people with certain genetic makeup should take more, certain people with certain genetic makeup should take less. Maybe the timing of administration is a problem. So I would just argue that we need more information, not that anybody should change anything they're doing right now. And I think that, again, I think that there's a lot of important benefits from immunizations, and I don't think people should have their children not receiving immunizations. I think there's a lot of benefit from folic acid being given to pregnant women, and we just need more information to be sure there's not any accompanying undesirable contribution.
One more question?
That'd be great. The other question I have is regarding the administration of terbutaline to the children that are premature in stopping the labor and delivery. It would be my understanding that most likely twins would get, the mothers of twins would get terbutaline.
Twins and triplets, they're more likely to have premature labor and get terbutaline.
So have you seen an increase of autism in twins, fraternal or identical, with that factor involved?
There's some articles in the literature, but I haven't seen anything that addresses the terbutaline in the context of that. There's some articles, yes and no, that maybe there's an increased incidence of autism in twinning. In twin pregnancies, there is a general increase in disability. So the possibility that a child will have some kind of disability is greater if they're a twin than if they're a singleton. People don't tend to appreciate that so much, and it's related at least in part to the birth process, and the risk is much higher for the second-born twin than it is for the first-born twin. And presumably the second-born twin has a greater chance of having some oxygen deprivation or something as the first twin is delivered. So it's quite complicated to interpret these kinds of things. We know that, the incidence of mental retardation is higher in twins than it is in singletons, and it's higher in second-born twins than it is in first-born twins. And so you have to keep in mind it's very complicated to interpret some of these things.
Dr. Ian?
Yeah, suppose I have a patient or, you know, a family has a child with autism, and they're curious about this folic acid possibility. How do you test, especially for extra folic acid? Can you measure it in the spinal fluid? Can you measure it in, say, a brain MR spectroscopy study? Those sorts of things.
I don't think there's really, in a routine basis out there, the kinds of information that is really helpful. We're interested in measuring this so-called unmetabolized folic acid or free folic acid that is not converted to the more active forms. And as part of this study, we had a very hard time finding anybody that can measure it reliably. There's one laboratory at the Tufts Nutrition Center that really has credible experience in quantitating unmetabolized folic acid. So it was hard for us even to arrange on a research basis that we could get some of these measurements done. I mean, you can send a folate level, red cell folate or plasma folate, to any routine send-out lab and you'll get back a number, but I don't know that I would know how to interpret it or that it would help me very much to know how to manage a child or anything. I do think, obviously, if a child has bad behavior in response to high doses of folic acid, most people would stop it and make the interpretation that maybe it's causing a problem and move on. But
one might expect that a mouse which is exposed to high folate diet would demonstrate some behavioral phenotypes, and there are tests which actually for animal models can equate to autistic behavior, the way they explore, the way they learn, the way they interact. Do you think that do you know if these animal studies have been done to test the hypothesis?
Huda Zoghbi's lab at our institution has been doing studies with administering folic acid to control mice and to mice with Rett syndrome and so on. And we've got some mutual interest in these kinds of questions. I don't think we've generated any data so far that are particularly instructive, but there's one of the people who was a postdoc with her, Paolo Moretti, now has got his own lab and an independent program, and he's continuing to look at the behavioral effects of high doses of folic acid and related compounds in mice with the kinds of social behaviors that you're talking about.
Can you comment on the cost of the CGH array available at Baylor compared to a typical high-resolution chromosomes? And
right now we're charging $1,500 for the chromosomal array. Chromosome analysis, karyotype analysis is, I don't know, typically $300 to $600, I guess. Prices vary quite widely. We're trying to make arrangements with a company that would do the billing and handling of array samples that would come to us on the basis that they would take whatever insurance would pay. It's a company that does a lot of rare genetic testing, Athena Diagnostics. They're despised by many in the genetics community as having a business model that's rather ruthless about using intellectual property to limit availability of genetic testing. But I think that before long, insurance will cover it, and I think also the price will drop rather substantially in the next. We started in February of 2004, and you know we were doing 10, 15 tests a month. Now we're doing 600 a month. So just the volume allows for price reductions, and there's intense competition from people like Agilent and Nimblegen and Illumina to provide arrays that would be of high quality at reduced price. If the volume goes up, the cost of the arrays goes down. I think that soon, like 2 to 3 years from now, it should cost the same as a karyotype but give you an enormous amount more information. It's basically intrinsically cheaper to do. You don't need anybody with much technical expertise. You can roboticize most of the stuff. The interpretation is straightforward. So before long, it will be the same price as a karyotype, and it will be covered by insurance. And it's my view that karyotypes will just go away, except when you have an abnormal array, you may need to do a karyotype to follow it up. I should say that many of my colleagues disagree with me. They think I'm nuts. But, we'll see.
When you mentioned the version 456, is that a standard version for the microarray?
It's just our local version as we've put increasing amounts of stuff on the array. We try to keep adding stuff on the array that will make diagnoses without increasing the frequency of detecting variants that we don't know how to interpret.
So when your lab talks about version 4, it's different than another center talking about their version?
Absolutely. Right.
If there are no more questions, I'd like to thank Dr. Bullitt for the very interesting presentation.
You've been listening to a podcast from University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at www.uctv.tv. Thank you for listening.